Amory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timmery.
We just passed Halloween, and you know what that means. 50-some days of shopping left until Christmas. Timmery, though, what the heck? You just told me you're already almost done your Christmas shopping.
I am almost done.
You're one of those people.
You know, I usually have it done a couple weeks early to begin with, but I have been, you know, shopping for Christmas presents for a couple months. Otherwise, it kills the budget to do it all at once. Listen,
Here's a trick. There's a trick for that. For not killing the budget, just don't buy the presents.
Just don't buy the presents.
I hear you, though. That's true. That's very wise. I appreciate that. I am not one of those people. I mean, even just this last week, I'm loath to say, so it was my son's birthday. And my wife and I, we know you don't get a big party every year. Okay. So if it's one of those years where you're not getting the big party, I'll admit maybe we, you know, don't put as much planning into it as we should. But we're also big Amazon shoppers. We love Amazon Prime, you know, it's like same day, next day.
Right.
And he woke up and we're like, sorry, buddy, here's a couple of presents, but your main presents aren't going to arrive until later in the day because I had been like an hour or two off on my Amazon. This is how closely I'm cutting it. I ordered the presents that we kind of knew, all right, we'll get them this, we'll get them that. And I ordered them a couple of hours too late. So they didn't arrive the night before. So I am so opposite of you. I'd be like, Christmas Eve, what can we get? Amazon Prime same day. I'm not getting paid by Amazon, by the way. That's just how we roll. That's just how we plan these things.
I remember last year too, I think it was my boyfriend, he got something for Christmas, but he got it like, we were exchanging presents like a day or two after Christmas because we weren't going to be together. And I find out Christmas Day, as he's unwrapping his presents throughout the day, he keeps getting things that I got him. And I'm like fuming, sitting here going, oh my gosh, you've already gotten this. And so I'm just getting more and more annoyed and finally go, okay, I'm just returning it all and I'm redoing the present. Amazon Prime, here we go.
Totally.
It worked out.
Oh yeah. It was kind of neat. I mean, you know, he's a good kid, you know, God bless him. He was pretty excited then for the doorbell ringing and the Amazon guy, he's rushing to the door.
Special delivery.
Got his packages. It was like an extra celebration, you know. After he woke up. I don't know. Maybe I'm just sort of trying to justify my own pathetic nature.
But you know what? Sometimes life gets in the way and, you know, there are different challenges that come up. And I feel like, too, at least for me, if I plan in advance, I spend a lot less because I have it pre-planned. And also I can simplify the present. It's more of a thoughtful present sometimes rather than me going, oh, I just need to get something and I spend more than I would. Rather, if I got something different, it would have been a little more thoughtful.
I hope your boyfriend is like checking this off because that seems like pretty good qualities in gift giving, far more thought than I'm putting into it, I got to admit. So lots of news this week. Where would you like to start?
I wanted to talk a little bit about prayer. You know, not too long ago, kind of a personal story, this last week, I was teaching and in the studio, this man walked up and he's a client that I have, you know, maybe once a week, really nice man. And, you know, I'm trying to get out the door. I'm tired and I'm not really wanting to stick around. You know, I've been teaching since really early. It's late at night at this point. I just want to get home and make some food. And, you know, all of a sudden the guy goes, oh, I'm sorry. You know, he knows he's taking a long time. He knows I want to leave. And, you know, yeah, I'm just not here right now. And ends up sharing with me that his daughter is in the hospital and he's been in and out seeing her back in, you know, the other side of the country. And she has a very rare blood disease that she contracted, some of the worst. I can't remember the name of it, but it doesn't look too good. And, you know, he all of a sudden sharing his story. And, you know, as he's talking to me, I'm thinking at the same moment how so often now you say the words to someone, I will pray for you, and they flinch. Some people, Some people you say, I'll pray for you, and they're really grateful, or they're quiet, or they're thinking about you. You can see in their mind them kind of questioning whether or not that's even going to be helpful. You know, and of course, that's not the first response you have. You know, you have by listening to them and understanding. So it sounds like what's happening and you're trying to understand their situation. But the end of the conversation, it's coming to an end. We're walking out. I'm locking up. And I said, well, I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to be praying for you and your family. And he said, you know what? I've not been telling anyone about this, he said, but I knew that you would pray for me, and that's why I told you.
Yeah.
And it was a moment where there's so many questions anymore, Don, of whether or not you tell someone, hey, I'm going to pray for you, because people can, I mean, sometimes have a visceral reaction anymore.
Yeah, well, and I think it varies depending on whether or not they actually think you're sincere most of the time.
Right.
There's a lot of dimensions to the story, and we're going to relate it to the church shooting, because the prayer thing seems to have taken on a life of its own after the horrible church shooting this week. So, but let's start with this, because I had a similar story actually not too long ago. A woman that my wife and I know, but not well. And we don't talk to her that often, but she shared with us that she was going through a divorce.
Oh.
And so this was a shock to her, shock
right.
to us. And our first response was, well, you know, we'll be praying for you. And I don't think she's actually a believer, this woman, but she took it in the same way. She's like, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And we actually do. Like, we actually do pray for her.
Yeah.
So in that, I don't think people are that angry about that, if it's legitimate. If you're
right.
actually right, I don't think that if it's within the context of a relationship and you're actually going to pray, I don't know. I mean, just, you'd have to be pretty hard-hearted to be mad about that. I think, on the other hand, people do get a little bit angry if you are just putting prayer out there as virtue signaling, right? As just saying, well, we have this activity, whatever it is, whatever story happens to be in the news this week, and here's how my tribe responds. We put up, you know, thinking of Paris or praying for San Bernardino or whatever, right.
right?
You put up the hashtag, you put up whatever. And both sides, here's what I find, both sides. So if you're a more secular liberal, what you're going to do is you're going to virtue signal by saying, you know, Boston Strong or something like this, right? That you're going to put that up there. And all of the conservatives are going to say, well, you're not actually doing anything. You're just putting up a sign, right? Why don't you do something? And I got the same response from people this week, I felt like, in response to the horrible Texas shooting, where we're saying, like, praying for, you know, Texas or whatever it is. And they're saying, you're not actually doing anything. You know, it's almost the same. I feel like it was the same attitude from the other side, where a more secular, more leftist, non-Christian tribe is going to say to the Christians, you're just throwing that up there as virtue signaling. You're not actually doing anything. Sometimes they're right about that,
yeah.
right? Like, sometimes that is just virtue signaling. Like, okay, we'll pray for you. Got it. Okay, we're going to move on. I'm thinking of something else. And so in that sense, I sort of get it, right?
Well, like, they're not being heard. And I think that's sometimes the issue. You know how often I'll tell someone, you know, I'll just, you know, say, yeah, you know, this is a really busy week. There's a lot going on. And you might say something that just happened. And the first reaction might either be, oh, I'll pray for you. It might be offer it up. Or it might
right.
be one of those, well, you know, just get through it. And your thoughts are, all I actually needed was for you to maybe listen for a second. I didn't need you to sit here and go, well, you know,
yeah, right.
I'll pray for you. You know, it's almost kind of like a slap sometimes. And I think that I even hear that coming from other people. And it shows kind of our lack of communication even often.
Yeah. And also self-focus. And I think that's what's got me a little bit irritated about some of the response to the Texas shooting, is that now we've got this online war between people who say, hey, prayer is useless, and
right.
people who are saying, no, prayer works. And, you know, mm. and we've got all this theology going out there, like God's in control. I mean, but it's become this battle between this side versus this side. And in the meantime, we've got entire families that are dead. Like
right.
to me, if your response to the Texas shooting is to defend yourself, you're doing the wrong thing, or to attack someone else, right? Either way, like, shouldn't we just take some time and think about the victims and do what we can for them? Like, if your interaction involves you or somebody else and you're battling, I think we've missed the train there somewhere.
Well, and I think, Don, you've really pointed out, you know, the issue, essentially what you're saying is, in a lot of ways, why are we spending time posting a Facebook status trying to create more awareness by saying, I'm praying for you, rather than let's just pull back and pray. Let's pull back and form. Right. What are we doing with our own lives? How are we, you know, how are we standing? And at the same time, yes, respecting the fact that prayer has a tremendous, tremendous impact, you know, both on us being selfless toward others and us forming who we are. You know, I think about it, you know, there's a reason that Jesus took on a human nature, human and divine. He worked in time, in human history, living with other people, and he prayed with them. He prayed for them. He fed them. He healed them. He spoke to them. He listened. You know, there's a combination of recognizing we can't just say, oh, I'm just going to pray for you. Yes, pray for me, right? But what can you do given the circumstance that you're in? Maybe you and I can't do that much because we're not in Texas. We don't know the victims.
Well, we can, but we can pray. And interesting, Jesus, at the same time as he was praying and helping the poor, he was pretty adamant that the religious leaders were spending too much time on their public persona. Like, they were like, when you pray, don't stand up like the hypocrites do and get everybody to look at them. Hey, look at me, I'm praying, right? Like, he's like, when you pray, go to your room and actually pray. Close the door. You don't need to make the big show of it. And if we, I think you're right, Tim, or if we spend a little bit more time actually praying rather than posting stuff, that might be more effective.
Absolutely. Well, and it makes me think too, you know, the readings, I was really thinking about this weekend, and in light of all of the sexual abuse and scandal over the last couple months, and we'll probably end up coming back to this just after this break, but it's been shocking to see sometimes the hypocrisy in the whole situation, also the lack of reverence. And I want to kind of bring this full circle around to the church.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Don and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So we've been talking about the Texas shooting and just the drama, truly just absolute drama over whether or not people are okay with you saying, I'll pray for you, I won't pray for you. And, you know, we're talking about how, you know, Jesus acted in human history. Jesus interacted with people. Jesus healed. He prayed with them. All these different elements that, you know, you're combining the human and the divine, and we're looking at Jesus as this true model for human interaction, intercession, and this perfect model. And I look, you know, as we've seen, I mentioned this before the break, everything that's happening with a sexual abuse scandal coming out of Hollywood. And, you know, we have been talking a lot about it here on Trending because it's something we cannot continue to not address. And very clearly, vocally. And, you know, this is the same thing that happened years back. And I'm sorry for little ears if you want to shut it off for a second. But, you know, with the sex abuse scandal with our priests. And, you know, this weekend we had those readings from Matthew talking about how you would call no man father, right? And not referring to someone as master. And, you know, our priests gave an excellent homily talking about how, you know, priests are held to a higher standard. And that's what was so shocking about the sex abuse scandal. You know, it's not that more priests abused individuals than any other industry of school teachers or, you know, all these other industries that are somewhat comparable in the interaction they have. It's just that priests, we expect more from them.
Yeah, and actually the epistles are very clear that as teachers, you know, you will be judged more harshly and you need to be,
right?
Yeah, if you're going to take on the responsibility of being a priest, certainly realize that you are held to a higher standard. I mean, I think that applies in many areas of life, like whatever role you happen to be, live up to the standard that you have. So as a father, I'm going to be judged more harshly than should Jesus return today, let's say. And we're all judged according to our state that we're in right now. I will be judged more harshly than my kids because I have them as my responsibility. I took that on when I, you know, started a family. And even for my wife, like, I'm responsible for all these things. I need to live to that standard. And yeah, that's a great point to me.
Yeah, and I look too, you know, you look at kind of the debate, even if we were to take this conversation up with our Protestant brothers and sisters, which are, I mean, truly, it's such a theme right now after the 500th year anniversary of the right. Reformation. But, you know, they might look at us and go, see, the scripture says, don't call any man father. But as we read, and they too read, St. Paul constantly talking about his children and admonishing his children and loving them with this fraternal love. We read in Hebrews, 1 Corinthians, Philemon, all these different books where you see, yes, the reason there's this address of fatherhood is that people were walking around with this pride of place, going, like you mentioned before, you know, oh, you know, I'm in sackcloth and ashes and I'm praying for people. There's this element of hypocrisy that we're trying to make sure we avoid. And that's part of this reading from Matthew, where Jesus is saying, call no man father or master, because you guys are just touting it around, similar to this topic of prayer.
I think it's very similar. In fact, you look at the context, just what you said, Tim, you look at the context of where he's saying, don't have anybody call you father, well, or rabbi. And right. He was called rabbi, right? Like right. People were calling Jesus rabbi. He didn't say stop that. He was making a point about whether you are out there just wanting the exaltation of others. And also, I would just add, I think this plays a little bit more into our current culture. And do you want the pat on the back from your tribe more than you want to reach other people? Okay, I think there is a sense in which all of those Pharisees, I don't think they were as stupid as to think that the person actually out there in the, you know, the hoi polloi, the lower people,
right,
that they actually were looking at them and saying, oh, aren't you great? You know, I when you're up and you're proud like that, I don't know that you get that sense. But you know who did think it was? All the other Pharisees, right? Like in their little club. They're thinking, we're cool. We're so great. I mean, oh, Rabbi, what's your name? And this, and oh, you guys are so, yes. And oh, those other people. Like, we're so, in fact, that's what the prayer was. The Pharisee would stand up and say, Lord, I'm glad I'm not like that guy. Right? And in scripture, it's very clear about that. And I just get the sense in our culture that that's a lot of what we see, even in this whole prayer thing. You know, so I mean, I'm looking at an article by Matt Walsh, and I actually like Matt Walsh a lot. I think he writes a lot of great stuff. This particular article I'm not a big fan of, because the headline is it, and maybe he didn't write this headline, but the headline in the article is, if you're responding to a massacre at a church by mocking prayer, please shut up. Now, okay?
He sometimes has no filter. I like him and I dislike him all at once.
I agree. I'm actually quite a big fan in this particular thing. But here's the thing. You've got a massacre. You've got a bunch of people who are dead. And we need to be concentrating on them. What's happening in this article is he's telling some other tribe, you shut up. And it's about me being right and you being wrong. And like I said in the first segment, if that's the issue now, it's you versus me. We're missing something, right? And if it's, I'm great, my side is great, we're right, you're an idiot, you should shut up. And we're talking about this in the context of a shooting, right? There's a lot of self-righteousness that's going on there that I think Jesus was talking to with this week's reading. Like, let no man, you know, put you, or don't consider yourself in this special club where everybody else is below you. That's where you get the whole father thing, right? Like, we're all equal dignity. We're all sinners here. We're all lost. We all need grace. On that level, we're all the same. And therefore, Paul's very explicit about this in Philippians, for example, do not consider anyone greater than anyone else, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're all the same. And if that's the case, and we're all sinners, and you have something like a shooting or whatever, I mean, our first response has to be, how can I help others? How can I help you as the person who said something vulgar on Facebook or whatever? How can I help you see the love of Jesus? Not how can I, you know, denigrate you and push you away even farther?
Well, and this conversation is not going to happen on Facebook.
Yeah, well, that's
Facebook,
true enough, yeah.
You know, I think that Facebook is a great place to share information, find information. It's a great place to share photos. But you guys, we've got to take this conversation offline. And I think that that's a huge part of this. You know, we're getting to a point where we're so just saturated in our device that we can't even kind of pull back to see, you know, praying the word or posting the words, I'm praying for Texas or I'm praying for wherever. Well, yes, that's a sign of solidarity. A lot of the time it's it just kind of fuels, you know,
in our current culture. Yeah.
And I'm not saying not to post. I'm praying for anyone. That's not what I'm saying at all.
In our culture, but you're right, Timmy. In our culture, everybody automatically like sees it politically. They see it socially as far as what, you know, what tribe are you in? And that's just not the gospel. That's the problem. I think the means, we have to be careful about the means we use because people interpret it in our current context.
Right.
Wrongly. Hopefully you're not saying, you know, those of you who aren't praying are idiots. Or
right.
I mean, you're just saying I'm praying. Okay. You know, fair enough. But is it virtue signaling? Are you just, you know, putting on the prayer robes and getting out there?
Are you actually praying? And I think this is one that gets me. Are we actually praying when we post something? Are we praying? Are we truly praising God when there is good news? You know, are we? And that's the moment. If we do not have time to pray, because we are so busy online posting about praying, posting about these topics. And I think that this is the issue. Remember, I helped in doing a survey not too long ago. It was a few years ago. And it was for a religious community. And they were trying to find information about women in a specific demographic in a certain area. And so there are a bunch of women that came together, a lot of whom are very, very, very are looked at as people who are very active in their faith in the community. And, you know, I was the one who had to kind of go through the surveys and grant, you know, everyone chose whether or not they wanted to put their name on. But I remember looking through and I was shocked because a lot of the surveys had to do with prayer. And I can tell you there was maybe one of them out of this group of about 30 women who actually prayed for more than about 15 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Only one of them. And we're talking about people who were heavily, heavily involved in different apostolates, different volunteer programs in the church. And so it made me question, both in my own life and in others, you know, I can't do what I'm doing right now and keep my head sane with what we're talking about in the culture if I'm not deeply rooted in faith. And I think that this is a moment of a reminder for each of us.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've never actually met a person who felt like they prayed enough. So that's a good sign.
Right.
I mean, and I'm there with you. I should be praying more. I just think like even the holy people that I know, people who do pray a lot, right? They're always like, yeah, I could do better. You know, and I think that's sort of the right attitude. It's like you said, Timmy, if you're out there living and it's not just, you know, covering all these topics, but just living, just life is too much for us. Because we're creatures, right? We are dependent on God. That's our nature. We live dependent on God. And to try to live independent of Him is not going to work. Prayer is that, and the Eucharist and all the other sacraments, but if you're not doing the prayer, you're not making that connection. I don't see how you can live dependent on God without prayer. And if you're living independent, trying to do it on yourself, I mean, good luck.
Well, and I think that this is a moment where we have to look practically as well, because I can't tell you how often I'll be speaking to a friend, family member, or even to someone when I'm speaking at an event. Well, how do I pray? What do I do? You know, and I think that one of those moments is, you know, it can be really hard to pray. We need guidance a lot of the time in prayer. And there are different steps along the journey where we need more support and we need less support. There are different forms of prayer. And I think a huge part of that is take the daily mass readings, sit and pray with the daily mass readings, read through them, pick a line, reflect on them, you know, go through the church's recommendation for Lectio Divina. This is something I love going to the parishes and teaching when I get to go in. Or, you know, pray your rosary daily. There's a reason we have the rosary to pray daily, because it gives us something to reflect on while we are praying those 10 Hail Marys.
Yeah. And not to be guilt inducing. It's not meant to be that, but just as a perspective giving thing, just look at your day and where all the time is going.
Right.
Like if you think, well, I just can't fit it in. Well, you probably fit in a lot of stuff, including how many hours on Facebook, right? A lot of stuff. And I think you can probably fit in. I'm with you. I'm the same way. We can fit in more time for prayer.
Timmy and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmy. That's TimmeRie. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmy on Relevant Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmy Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DonJohnsonMinistries.org or Timmy.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
As a father of four kids, Timmy, I find myself often thinking, man, I'm glad I don't live in this generation. And I know that's terrible, right? Like, they're my kids. I'm doing my best for them. But I feel like there's a lot of things that they're dealing with that I didn't have to. And I find it increasingly hard to protect them from it. And in fact, you look at some of the stories, several stories just this past week that came out. Kids are not doing very well these days.
No, kids are really struggling. You know, you see some 40% of teenagers have said in recent studies that they felt overwhelmed by all that they had to do. And, you know, the New York Times, The Week, everyone is talking about how teenagers are so incredibly stressed out. And, you know, a lot of what they're showing in these studies, you know, you have these teens who are suicidal, who are being put on antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, the ADD medication, you know, and you have these same kids and you hear about their day and how they're jumping from one activity to the next. They're being pressured to run for, you know, class president. They're being pressured to take care of, you know, the different sports and not just be in sports, but to be the best at the sport and have all of these extra elements and then to have good grades. And they're already supposed to know what they're studying in college. And, you know, just talking about it is stressful. And there has to be a point where you say, when are they allowed ever to just be a kid? These kids are terrified of failure. These kids, and I look at it and I go, it's just going to get worse. Because when you get to college and you have the challenges of the student loans and the grades and living on your own and the food and all these different elements, you know, are we helping kids to cope where they're at? And are we allowing them to just enjoy for a moment, to develop who they are and appreciate that there's a wonderful world around us that truly is great?
Yeah. The short answer to that is, Timory, no, we're not. We're not allowing them to be kids in general. And in one sense, the particular problems that you just elucidated are sort of a middle upper class issue, more so, but not entirely. You look at the stats, and the New York Times did this long form piece. It's very exhaustive. They talked to a lot of kids from various socioeconomic differences, and they're all struggling, all having a hard time. But this particular one, I think I want to start there and then sort of peel back the onions and see what is the issue. Because they are, I mean, medically, there's huge problems here. Like, the kids just literally cannot handle life. And it starts with the idea, and it doesn't just start even in high school. I know elementary school kids. I've talked to their parents, and the parents say, listen, the kids have to compete. They have to compete. They have to be able to compete. And if they do not, where are they going to get? That's word for word what they say. So the kid grows up with basically just what you said. So they grew up saying, listen, I need to grow up and make a lot of money and have a job that other people esteem. In order to do that, I've got to get into a good college and possibly a good graduate school. In order to get into a good college, I have to do really well, not only in high school, but starting in junior high with my academics, but not just my academics. I have to have all these extracurricular activities that I need to be really good at so that I can have this resume to give to the school that I'm going to eventually. And they're thinking about this when they're like 10.
Right. And that they feel like failures if they don't get, whether it's the part they want, the position on the team that they want, the team that they wanted to land, whether it's the class, the AP class, the quiz, you know, all these different elements. These poor kids, it's almost like they're automatically being set up for failure in some ways.
Well, yeah, absolutely they are. And those kids that do are not able. Maybe they're just not able. They're not good memorizers or whatever. You can see how their self-esteem would be crushed. And, oh, my future, I have no future. I'm done. What are we going to do here? And so you've got this intense, materialistic, career-oriented mindset among that. Again, that's among a certain subset, but it's a pretty large subset of American youth. Now, here's what's interesting. This adds another layer to it that I don't think these articles get to, but if you read the right literature and talk to the right people, this adds an extra element to it. It's the sexually promiscuous hookup culture combined with this, and they go tightly together. Tightly together. I was just reading a very interesting book. It's called Unhooked, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the author, but if you can handle it, it's not easy reading because it's like reading that divorce book we talked about by Layla Miller. The pain is intense. But here's what these kids say. I can't have a relationship. I can't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend because that would, one, take too much time. And hey, what if I fall in love with that person and we want to stay together? I mean, that's not going to work. Right. So that's off the table Okay, there is no, I'm not going to have a boy or a girl that I want to commit to. But I'm also not going to wait until I'm 30 to have sex. Okay, that's not going to happen.
So I don't have time for a relationship, but I have time for a one-night stand and all the emotional struggle that comes with that.
Well, we're not going to... Yes,
we
well,
won't even
we
go
don't
down
know
that
we,
road.
Well, yeah, they're not thinking about that.
They're thinking,
I'm guarding myself. I'm keeping my emotions out of it. That's why we're just going to hook up. That's why I don't even really want to know your name. You read the hookup culture is so distancing. That's why the book's called Unhooked, because it's so distancing. I prefer not to know your name. And if I like you, actually, we're not going to hook up. It's the people that I don't care about there. I'm going to. But here's the problem, Tim Reese, like you said, you can't. That doesn't actually work, does it?
It doesn't work.
You know, can't just give your body to somebody, expect that you're going to be emotionally stable after that.
You've chemically bonded yourself to another individual. The way your body and your mind have now created this view and perception of this person, sex was meant to for marriage. The chemicals and the hormones that come off when we are having sex is something that is meant to bond permanently a relationship with another person. You have sex outside of marriage. Doesn't matter if it's a one-night stand to you. You've bonded to an individual. Your body is desiring and looking to connect with that person still.
Yeah.
And, you know, I keep looking at this too. You know, you add the sex element, you add the pressure of these kids. You know, I know, you know, I was just talking to, you know, this young girl I know, and, you know, she's looking at stopping dancing. And I'm looking at this and, you know, kind of asking why. And she said, well, they put so much pressure for us to be super skinny, to expect us to be dieting all the time. And, you know, I look at it and having grown up in that world, I mean, there was a point where we were being weighed every week, how much fat we had on our bodies. And, you know, I remember my body fat level was higher than some of the others, and they would talk about it. And you'd have girls who were in the bathrooms throwing up because they wanted to make sure that there was more bone visible on their bodies. And, you know, luckily, I always had, even though, you know, there was this discomfort that you would feel in that judgment, you know, when people would compare numbers, you know, I had a decent sense of security in my body. But, you know, a lot of these girls, and, you know, someone said she just wants to be a kid. She just wants to enjoy life. She doesn't want to have to try to do something she loves and have all this pressure. You know, you look at this and it's like, the world is telling these young kids, you are not enough unless you do more. You do more. There's never a sense of resting. And you think about heaven and the beatific vision. It's being in the vision of God. It's a resting place in God. It's a, you are with me. I am with you. We've worked through all of your challenges, all of these elements, and you're resting with me. And this is part of prayer too. We're resting with God. We're with him. We're connected to him. But the lifestyles that, whether you're young or old, and this expectation of personal success and constant achievement, are we allowing ourselves to rest?
Well, this is an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up. I think you can pull that out even farther. Not only are you allowing yourself to rest, like, day by day, right? Like, give yourself a little break. It's
okay. But in who you are.
But just in your whole life. Yeah, like, what is the point of your life? Like, what is this whole thing about, right? Like, what is your goal as a person? What's the meaning? How are you going to gauge at the end of the day? At the end, let's say that this is your last week, that somehow you find an active shooter situation in your work, and this is it. How will you judge whether or not your life was a success? Unfortunately, we are teaching our children that to be successful, that to have a successful life, when you look back at the end of your life, you will have been a success if you have made a lot of money, got a career that everyone thinks is important, not even that you enjoy, but that other people look at and say, oh, good job, and that you have had along the way a lot of sex, right? Is anyone going to look back at their life and say, oh, yeah, I did great. I look at my career. Look at all the money I made. I think what you will find is nobody on their deathbed looks back and say, oh, yeah, I wish I had spent more time in the office. I wish I had had more promiscuous sex. I wish I had had more pleasure. Chances are you will look back and look at relationships. And that here's why. The meaning of life is love. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, how you love God, but that plays out in how you love others.
Right.
You are going to be a successful person no matter how much money you make, no matter what career you have. Mm-hmm. You can have the lowliest career according to the world. But if you are a person who loves God and loves others, you have been a success. Check. Like, you will have the great mansion in heaven. You, for all of eternity, people will look up to you and say, wow, you had it right. I wish I had had my priorities better down on earth, because you clearly did. Yeah, but I was a trash guy or whatever. Yep. Who cares? Right? You love God. You love others. You develop the virtues that come along with that. It's the beatific vision. Like, that's the thing. That's what life is about. And we're just, even as Catholics, I'm sorry to say, even as Catholics, we're skewing our priorities for our kids by telling them, by putting so much pressure on them. Hey, you got to do this and this and this and this. You got to compete. Do you? Right? I don't think so.
Do they? And here's a question. Do they have time to just stop for half an hour, any point, maybe a couple times throughout the week, and legitimately be bored? If they can't be bored without having a cell phone around and go, you know what, I have to go find a way to go play outside. I have to pick up a deck of cards and see who will play a game with me. Or maybe I'm going to sit here flipping and playing solitaire on my own. Or maybe I'm going to pick up a book. You know, do your kids have those moments to just stop? Do we have those moments to just stop? You know, and just be for a minute. You know, I went to the ballet this weekend. I just thought, you know, it's such a beautiful moment to stop and not compare. Oh, I wish I could be dancing again. Oh, I could look at how beautiful and wonderful this dance is.
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending.
Trending.
With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So I'm not only talking about teenagers and being stressed out, but my generation, the millennial generation, I see over and over again just such incredible pressure and truly a lot of sorrow over the topic of stress and more so student loan debt. But that's not the only stressful element that I think a lot of millennials face today. You know, they are coming into a tough job market. A lot of them are working multiple jobs in order to make ends meet as they're focusing on average $80,000 in student debt. You know, according to the study by the American Psychological Association, 18 to 35-year-olds are most stressed-out generation ever, earning themselves the nickname, literally, of Generation Stress.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we talked about the high schoolers that are stressed out right now, and the trend in young adult fiction is now towards sort of a nihilism, where suicide is a way out.
Right.
But as you look at how the generations, as they pass through the various stages of life, you might think, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, teenagers, that's a tough time. It's a tough time. And, you know, once they get through that, though, once they get the career, once they get the money, that things will be better. Everything will work out. And it's interesting you talk about the millennials being the most stressed. I saw a different study that actually said it was middle-aged women. Middle-aged women. And here's why.
I'm the most stressed out. I'm the most stressed
They are
out.
The most stressed because on top of everything else. So let's walk it through. So the teenagers have all this stress because I need to pass my exam and I need to not have a boyfriend and I need to get into the right college and do all the extracurricular stuff and be the best on the volleyball team and all that. And then they get to college and it's the same thing, only the hookup culture gets bigger and worse. And if they can get through college and get into the career, then, I mean, surely they're happy by that time. And you get into your 30s and you realize, huh, this actually isn't as fulfilling as I had hoped it would be. And now I've got the nice apartment, or maybe even I've got, you know, a condo or a house, and I've got the live-in boyfriend, although maybe, you know, I cheat on him once in a while. And hey, everything's just not so happy. But finally, you get to your late 30s and you say, okay, now I'm far enough in my career, I'm going to have a kid. And oh gosh, it's a little hard to find a guy who wants to settle down with me right now and have a kid. And you know what? I actually physically am having a hard time finding a kid right now. And oh, now my mother is sick and now I've got to take care of her. the middle-aged woman, like the 39 to 50-year-old stage where they've got a troubled relationship, maybe they're having some issues with fertility, or maybe they've got one or two kids, plus the husband was divorced and the stress is just extrapolate and keep getting bigger and bigger actually as you get older. And you think, maybe we need to step back a little bit and say, maybe that story we were told when we were teenagers that money and promiscuous sex is going to provide you happiness. Maybe that was all a lie. Maybe that has led to every single problem we now face further down the line. I mean, you look at every single generation from the $80,000 in student loan debt to the fertility crisis. I mean, it seems to me that every single one can be you can look back and say, I was lied to when I was a kid.
Right. And I think that a lot of young people today, it's a moment of crisis of existence at the same time, because the student loan debt isn't just student loan debt. But I think for a lot of people, you know, it makes them go, I'm working so hard. I have all these things and, you know, things are supposed to be good. I'm supposed to be, you know, I'm Catholic, I'm Christian. I'm supposed to have, you know, faith, but I'm having a hard time. And I think it's leading a lot of people to just lose the hope and despair often. And I do have to say, you know, I am living in this millennial generation. I do have student loan debt. I'm choosing to work in an apostolate and I am working multiple jobs, you know, and a lot of the time I'm not making anything in a lot of the work we're doing in the apostolate. And, you know, you look at it and I've chosen this lifestyle in part. I could go and work a different job. I could, you know, I'm working Pilates to supplement what I'm doing, but I look at it and I go, I couldn't discuss the things we are on air. Even this morning, prepping for the show and a show we're going to be recording later this afternoon and we'll be sharing, it'll be available on Sunday. You know, I just had to stop and I go, I would not be able to face what we have going on in this culture if it were not for my faith. And trusting that, yes, money can be a challenge, relationships can be a challenge, all these different abuses and experiences people have can be a challenge. But what matters is that we are working on being good people, that we are learning to love our Lord and be united to Him in the sacraments, that we're running to the confessional, and that we're not searching out for a priest who's going to give us some great advice on some pornography addiction, on something going on in a relationship, but that this priest is there acting in persona Christi, forgiving our sins in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and is fortifying us with the grace to then go and receive Him in the Eucharist. And that is food for the journey.
Yeah, without God, without that relationship with Jesus, without the sacraments, without all of those things, yeah, it's going to be impossible. The alternative to that is despair, right? Without God, you're not ultimately going to have hope and meaning. And the alternative to hope and meaning is nihilism and despair. And actually, I think that's, I mentioned the young adult fiction, an interesting article I read this week that I'm looking at right now. It talks about how even in the past, say, 10 to 15 years, how young adult fiction has changed a little bit. Whereas for a while there, you had books like The Hunger Games and Divergent, where, you know, people are afraid for their safety and the world's going to collapse, but we'll stand strong and we'll fight through it. And the strong young women will save us. Now, the trend is more 13 Reasons Why, which, as we've talked about, is that the answer here is just to exit, is suicide.
Suicide
rates. And the reason suicide would be an alternative is because it's complete despair. Like, there is no hope. There is no future. Even if I fight and win this particular battle, you know, like in the Hunger Games or whatever, ultimately it's all for nothing. And that's where we're at now with our, we've got to step in as a church and offer them Jesus. And again, I almost hate to make this political again, but you know what we're doing a lot of times is we're stepping in and we're offering them that political movement or that club or that, you know, we're hunkering down. I feel like a lot of kids look at Christianity in America and they say, oh, well, that's for you folks who, you know, vote a particular way or whatever, or that's for that particular movement. No, right? That's not it. If that's how they're understanding the church and understanding Christianity, we've got to do something different. We've got to offer them Jesus.
Well, and what are we offering them most of the time? Especially, I mean, young teenagers, young adults, we're offering them basically things to cover it up. Antidepressants, yeah. Anti-anxiety medication, hormonal birth control, all of which have connections to us being not in the same state of mind. And add the stress that we're experiencing today. Talk about mental illness. talk about mental illness when you have high stress that teens have never seen before and all these medications, you're seeing people, and I've seen firsthand these people who are on these different types of medications and they're despairing because you keep removing them farther and farther from what they're looking for is God. What they're looking for is good order in their life. What they're looking for is a slowing down of their pace, love from their family, good, strong relationships that are virtuous and chaste.
Well, the family thing is huge. You just reminded me as you're talking, I was just reading an article about the number one social justice issue in the country. It's about family, right? We refuse as a culture, it seems to me, we refuse to go to the root of some of these problems. Like a kid is acting out and is angry and is despair, but we refuse to look at, well, what kind of family situation do they come from? What kind of sexual activity are they involved in? All of these questions, what kind of beliefs about God do they have, right? Like all of that stuff, but particularly the family. And that goes back to, ultimately, what's the meaning of life?
Right.
Is the meaning of life that we are put here to love God and to love others. And the clearest sacrament of living the image of God out on earth is a family. It's a man and a woman coming together to produce a family and to grow up other men and women who then go and live together and produce a family. This has been the model. We're in a nasty, nasty social experiment at the moment where we're trying to make it work without that as the model. And it's not going well.
This is our small church within the family. We learn unconditional love. We learn selflessness. We learn sacrifice. We learn when we're selfish. We learn all of these different elements of the human person and human existence and lessons of love and mistakes and forgiveness within the family. But when we are saying we are no longer going to have chaste relationships, we're no longer going to have fertile sex, we're no longer going to have then children, you're changing your body, putting it in states of pseudo-pregnancy, adding different levels of stress and anxiety that is stepping us further and further away from this path of truly human growth and flourishment. And we're literally shutting the door on that basic human growth where every person comes from, and that's from a family.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a maturing thing, right? The family is a maturity incubator. It teaches you as a parent, you're going to grow as you take care of others. As siblings, you're going to grow as you learn how to put your needs and desires after somebody else's, right? And that's what it is, as you learn to interact. Those that don't have that, that don't have that model for love, which is what a family is supposed to be. I understand there's bad families, but there's a lot more bad families because they're not intact, right? That's one of the reasons they're bad families. Those that grow up in that nuclear family have just a huge benefit of ultimately learning how to love.
Right. Even if it's not perfect.
Yeah, of course, it's never going to be perfect. We're all sinners. It's never going to be perfect. But that family structure in and of itself is such a benefit. And we abandoned that to our great detriment.
From the studios of Relevant Radio, this has been Trending with Don and Timmery. Trending. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.